Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Okay, you've heard the question 1,000 times. Are you a Beatles person or a Stones person? Seems like we've all had to pick sides in the greatest rivalry in rock music. But then again, the Beatles wrote this song, I Wanna Be Your Man, for the Rolling Stones, so how real was this rivalry? In his new book, music historian John McMillan says it wasn't, except for when it was. The book is called, naturally, Beatles vs. Stones, and John McMillan joins me in the Soundcheck studio. John, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So if the rivalry wasn't real from the beginning, why are we still talking about this 50 years? I mean, this is one of the most popular things we've ever done on Soundcheck.
Well, it was a competitive friendship. You know, both groups liked each other, and they got along, and they could bond over a lot of their shared experiences. They admired what the other groups were doing. And yet, at the same time, they never really stopped competing for aesthetic credibility or cultural influence or record sales and everything else.
And it is sort of part of the fun of being a music fan, isn't it? To be able to, like, argue music with your fellow fans.
Well, sure, because you know, they both had so much in common. They were about the same age. They came out of England. They both admired African-American artists. But then there were also some clear differences, and I think it's the differences that make the comparison irresistible.
Right, despite things like, I want to be your man, which shows them not as rivals at all, but as kind of, you know, as friends.
Right. At that point, the Rolling Stones had not yet shown that they could write their own songs. So Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were doing, you know, cover songs. And the Beatles came in and wrote I Wanna Be Your Man for the Stones. It was their second single and their first kind of big hit in England. And the Beatles were happy to do it because they got some prestige from seeing other bands record their songs. And they had more songs than they knew what to do with in some senses.
Mm-hmm.
And the Stones enjoyed doing a Lennon McCartney song to get going.
And was it John who said, well, we didn't give them anything good?
That's right. That's right. Mick thought that he was, you know, he flattered himself and thought the Beatles had given him one of his best songs. And John said, no, that was a throwaway.
I wanna be your man.
So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, you said they were approximately the same age. They were from England. They shared a love of African-American music. But there were some marked dissimilarities, which, you know, ironically got sort of reversed in the public perception of these two bands.
Right. And one big difference is the class backgrounds of the two groups. And there were different class distinctions within each group. But on balance, you know, the Beatles were working class kids from Liverpool, and in England's class system, there just wasn't as much mobility as we see today, and so they were just facing a career of having low wage, low prestige vocations, and also the fact that they were from Liverpool mattered a lot to people from London, because Londoners looked down at Liverpool the way maybe someone from New York City might look at someone from the Deep South or Appalachia. They had a kind of snobbish, condescending attitude, and so the Stones, by contrast, who of course presented themselves as the more, you know, louche, you know, edgy or radical types, they were actually on balance much better off class wise than
the middle class kids.
Mick Jagger got into the London School of Economics, which is a very prestigious school, and this was at a time when only about 2% of British kids even went on to universities. And Brian Jones did not go to a university, but he could have. He was an outstanding student, and his parents were upper middle class.
So how is it that the Beatles, who, you know, came from this rough and tumble neighborhood, went to an even rougher, tumbler neighborhood in Hamburg to hone their craft, how did they get to be the good kids? And the Stones, who actually were from pretty good families, were the ones seen as the rebels.
Right. Well, this was marketing. So, you know, when the Beatles first encountered their manager, Brian Epstein, they were still wearing leather and they were playing loud rock and roll and they were a little wild. when they were on stage, they would drink and eat and smoke and make wisecracks and everything else. And he was the one who gradually got them into suits and had them bow and conform and be polite. And with regard to with the Stones, it was a bit different. And initially, their first manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, wanted to style the Stones kind of like the Beatles. He had them in matching outfits and everything else. But that didn't last for very long. After a while, he allowed the Stones to, you know, present themselves in a more easygoing way. And even he encouraged them to be a little bit insolent in the way they dealt with interviewers and so on. And that contributed to their reputation.
And in a classic case of the grass always being greener, each band saw in the other something that they wanted. The Stones saw the success of the Beatles, and the Beatles saw this kind of cool factor going over to the Stones.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the Stones certainly were envious of the Beatles' commercial success. And although we talk about the groups being rivals, the Beatles always outsold the Stones by a pretty wide margin. But John Lennon especially, he looked at the Stones and, you know, John Lennon came from art school. He was a bohemian type. I think he would have preferred to have that image, the image that the Stones had. And John had the hardest time of all the Beatles, you know, conforming to the expectations that their manager set. And he had a hard time with the lovable mop-top image.
Right. We're speaking with John McMillan. His book is called Beatles versus Stones. It is out now, looking at the enduring and supposed rivalry, which was, you know, I mean, if we're still talking about it 50 years later, there's something to it. But again, they were friendly, they were supportive of each other, they were in this rarefied atmosphere at the upper echelon of pop. There wasn't a lot of company up there. Even as late as 1967, we have the Beatles helping out the Rolling Stones. You write about the session where they were trying to record the song We Love You, and it just wasn't happening. And what's the thing that turns that session around?
Well, the Stones were not getting along very well. They had a lot, you know, and they were frustrated with what was going on in the studio. And John Lennon and Paul McCartney showed up. And very quickly, by every account, they helped to restructure the song around their own high backing vocals. And they took a song that was not going anywhere and made it into a pretty terrific song. That's an interesting one because in England it was a kind of a big hit. I think maybe it hit number 8 in England, but not in the United States.
Here it was a B-side, as I recall. We Love You is the song from the Rolling Stones with an assist from the Beatles. We go. That is the Rolling Stones with We Love You, recorded in 1967. Paul's voice is hard to pick out, John, but John Lennon's high nasal voice, you can hear that in the background of the chorus there, singing We Love You. I mean, you write in the book, this is one of numerous examples of the Stones kind of following the Beatles' lead, right?
That's right. The Beatles had this big hit with All You Need Is Love, which seemed to capture the spirit of the summer of love and the counterculture and whatnot.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love. Love. Love is all you need.
And And so here was the Stones doing a similar song. And John Lennon later on remarked that he thought he was a little peeved at the way the Stones seemed to be following in what the Beatles were doing.
So was the song perceived by the public as the Stones aping the Beatles, or was it perceived maybe as a kind of slam against the Beatles?
Not a slam against the Beatles, but the Stones all of a sudden began to present themselves as sort of hippies. And later on, they would come up with their album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, and they show up on the cover with dressed in wizard outfits and, you know, looking
very like hobbitish.
Absolutely. That wasn't really what their aesthetic was about. It seemed like they were glomming on to a fad. And the Stones were not the only group to do that. But certainly it seemed like they were following the Beatles' creative lead for a while there.
We're speaking with John McMillan about his book, Beatles versus Stones, which examines the sort of creation myth of the Beatles versus Stones rivalry, whether it was real or marketing or imagination or some combination of all the above. Listeners, what do you think? Was it all fiction? I mean, did you really feel stronger about one band than the other? Give us a call, 866-939-1612. Were you a Beatles person or a Stones person? Or were you one of those people who said, I don't understand the difference. It's all music to me. 866-939-1612. Or leave us a comment at soundcheck.org. Speaking of the Stones kind of following the Beatles' footsteps, there are numerous examples that you bring up during the course of the book, one of them going all the way back to the early Beatles song Yesterday. What does this show to us?
Well, Yesterday is a song that is credited to the Beatles, but it's almost completely Paul McCartney's song. He wrote the entire thing, and none of the other Beatles perform in that song. It's just Paul and a quietly strummed guitar, and then they have a string arrangement in the background.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
Of course, that was a huge hit for the Beatles. And then sometime shortly afterwards, the Stones came out with their song called As Tears Go By, which had Mick Jagger singing to a quietly strummed guitar with a string arrangement. The interesting thing is that the Stones wrote As Tears Go By first, but they didn't think they could really record it. It didn't suit what they were doing. And Keith Richards was very clear. He said if we took that song to the rest of the group, they'd have laughed us out of the room. So they didn't think of the As Tears Go By was a Stones song, but then the Beatles seemed to be opening up a new frontier for pop music, changing the rules of the game a bit, and so the Stones released this song and had a lot of success with it.
So they went back to a song that they'd originally given to Marianne Faithfull to record and reclaimed it for themselves because now it was okay to sing a ballad with a string section behind you.
That's exactly right.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play. Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as tears go by.
One example of the Beatles kind of paving the way and then the Stones coming along and doing it their way. We're speaking with John McMillan about his book, Beatles versus Stones. Once again, listeners, were you a Beatles fan or a Stones fan? Or were you one of those people who thought it was all just marketing and you liked or disliked both? Call us at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment at soundcheck.org. John, at some point, did this kind of friendly rivalry, which seemed to flow naturally out of two groups of young men in the same field at the same time. At some point, did this friendly rivalry turn genuinely nasty?
There are a few times in the very late 60s where the groups took to sniping at each other a bit in the press, and it was mainly John Lennon who was going through a difficult period, who, in a very famous tirade with Rolling Stones publisher Jan Wenner, tore into the Stones for mm-hmm. for mimicking the Beatles and copying them. And that seemed to be his main complaint. But Mick Jagger said some tardy things as well about the fact that the Beatles had made their breakup such an acrimonious story for the press, and that he thought there was something a little tacky about what the Beatles were doing. And as I alluded to before, I do believe Mick Jagger, of all the Stones, resented the Beatles' commercial success mm-hmm. and would have liked to have reveled in some of that.
But you also write a fair amount about the kind of political views, not of the bands, who seem not to have very strong political views, but of the young people of the day and how they viewed these two bands was really quite interesting.
Yeah, this is what really got me hooked into the project many years ago. I was doing research on underground newspapers in the late 60s. And I don't know if people remember, but there were these countercultural and radical newspapers all across the country. And right around the summer of 1968, there was a huge debate among, you know, youth culture aficionados over which group had the right political perspective. And the Beatles were seen to endorse, you know, the hippies and flower power and gentle nonviolence and whatnot. And the Stones seemed to align themselves with the more militant, you know, street fighting ethic of the radical new left. Mm-hmm. And as you were mentioning, I don't think either group was terribly committed to one strategy or the other. And so there was something a little bit stylized about this. But young people thought it was profoundly important.
Well, but they must have been very conflicted when John Lennon wrote Revolution. Because, I mean, just to listen to the lyrics
right.
here, you know, it's almost like kind of a smackdown of everything the youth movement was about.
You say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be all right? All right. All right.
And then the Stones had their song Street Fighting Man right on the heels of that. And those two songs, situated next to each other, seem to suggest a kind of ideological debate.
Everywhere I hear the sound of marching George feet, though. Cause summer's here and the time is right for rising in the street, though. And what's down for the way to set the same for rock and roll.
John McMillan, the Beatles song has the sound of revolution with the distortion and the guitar and the vocals, but Lennon singing Count Me Out, the Stones with the sitar suggesting flower power and hippies are out there, you know, marching, charging feet, street fighting man.
Yeah, well, there's something discrepant certainly about the sound of revolution and the political message that that song contained, because, you know, this was the time of 1968, the Democratic Convention and the assassinations of Martin Luther King, and even around the world, in Paris and Mexico, students and the police were clashing. And John Lennon he wanted a more gentler approach mm-hmm. from young people, and that's what he was suggesting. Mick Jagger had apparently attended a anti-war rally in London around the time, shortly before he wrote Street Fighting Man, and that was perhaps the impetus for the lyrics. And he felt a little bit impotent because, you know, he couldn't really be out there, you know, at the barricades the way he claimed to want to be.
Well, you write in the book that, you know, he probably went there thinking it would be like a social event.
I don't think there's a lot of evidence that Mick Jagger had a very developed left-wing political consciousness.
So even here, even in this kind of final chapter of the Beatles-Stones rivalry, when it comes to politics, was there anything to it, or was that all manufactured as well?
It's hard to say. You know, John Lennon is such an interesting character to me because I think he was very bright but not particularly well-educated or well-informed. And, you know, he has the reputation for being the peacenik and everything else. But he was quite conflicted. You know, sometimes he actually seemed to endorse political violence, yeah. which is contrary to how people think of him. And again, with Mick Jagger, certainly the Stones are even more interested than a lot of people in making a lot of money. And I think that his radicalism was a bit faddish. I can't prove it, but he's never seemed committed to any real left-wing political cause.
John McMillan's book is called Beatles versus Stones. It's out now. And John, you somehow go through this entire book without letting us know which side of the divide you come down on. Although you do say early on, I'm a Nestorian. I'm not going, you know, it's not for me to come down on one side or the other here, but take off your historian hat for the moment. Beatles or Stones?
Well, see, I get asked this question all the time, and I hate to be impolite, but I don't want to take a position in the book. And part of the reason is because, as you suggested, it's not my skill set to write about aesthetics. I'm not a musician or a rock critic. But also, I didn't want people to get into some kind of acrimonious dispute as they read the book.
So in other words, the rivalry endures and is still so close to people's hearts that even you writing this book and stating one position or another will get people's goat. Is that what you're saying?
I've already found that to be the case. In various online fora, people think that I've sided with one group or the other. What brings me satisfaction is that people seem not to know what I really believe. My friends know. I do have a strong opinion, and my friends know which band I like. But readers have not been able to determine conclusively.
And although I noticed the use of the word satisfaction in your sentence there.
Oh, so you think that implies something? No. I'll tell you, the book is about how the rivalry was constructed by fans and by people in the media and by the groups themselves. And that's what I want people to focus on as opposed to whether they think I'm, you know, favorable to one group or the other.
All right. Fair enough. Actually, it's not fair enough, but I guess that's what we'll end with. John McMillan is the author of the book Beatles versus Stones, and you can read it and decide for yourself where his secret sympathies lie. John McMillan, thanks for being with us on Soundcheck today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Soundcheck is a production of WNYC in New York. Find out more about our show at soundcheck.org or just download the new WNYC mobile app. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck. Let me understand.